more unto the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
Man, you were fast on that last
one. I am uber, hyper, overclocked.
Too much coffee?
No. There's no such thing as too much coffee.
That may be the issue.
No. I'm perfectly normal. Normal. Okay. I feel better now. Right. Thank you. I needed that. Anyway, if today is Saturday, April 11th, the year of our Lord, 2015, and you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and you have a means of telecommunication, verbal in nature, you may call 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400
and have the opportunity to listen to inanities beyond normal human comprehension. Anyway, that's us. And as a disclosure, the Personal Wealth Coach is not only a brilliant and delightful and entertaining and exciting, those are hyperbole, yeah, radio presentation that comes on every Saturday morning, riveting people to their beds across the listening area.
I would say riveting eyelids closed.
Causing people to drool on their radios.
Losing focus.
Yes, anyway, or D, all of the above. It also happens to be the name, purely non-coincidentally, of an investment advisory firm registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission that is resident in Salado, Texas, although its two principals are, if this is Saturday the 11th of April, its two principals are currently in Temple.
Yes, not in Salado.
And it always amazes me when people say, I say to them, like, well, where do you work, or where do you assist? And they say, I am in Dallas.
Right.
And
I'm in Dallas.
And we're standing in Austin at
or
that moment.
San Antonio.
Yeah. But
you are not in Dallas.
No.
Like, you've got a little bit of a problem geographically.
You seem to have a problem here in that it appears to me that you don't know where you are. And, you know, we know, generally speaking, where we are in a sense on the surface of the earth. Of course.
Sort of.
It really is difficult because we're moving at around 144,000 miles an hour at night and a little bit about 140,000 miles an hour in the daytime.
That's only in relation to the sun, though.
Yes, well, in relation to the center. We're
going a lot faster than that.
Yeah, we're actually going like a million miles an hour or something.
So if you think about trying to figure out where you are at any given moment when we move this fast, just be glad that they're not saying they're in China when you ask them what they do, where they live,
yes,
and where,
yes,
they work, and so on.
Yes, I am in China.
No, oh, sorry, we're moving so fast.
I think
my house actually is in Dallas, but China and Dallas are so close together when we're moving this quickly.
That's right, and which is, by the way, to run off on a completely babble-baked
as if
direction.
We weren't already. This already is a babble-baked direction.
I actually get the biggest kick out of time travel.
Books?
Movies or whatever.
Because I time travel regularly.
Well, but I'm talking about the ones where people go back in time.
Oh, yeah. See, I travel forward in time 1 second at a time.
Really?
Yeah. Each time travel that it's a forward moving.
Very consistently, yes.
It just happens to be at the same forward moving speed that everybody else is.
Well, the issue is, of course, that if you were to travel in time backwards a year, just exactly 1 year.
Right.
And you were to pop out 1 year ago, you could somehow reverse yourself in time, you would be hanging in the middle of empty space because the sun has not arrived here. The Earth hasn't arrived here yet.
You just have to figure out how to travel the same distance in
space.
Space, which is time, space-time, as you did in
You'd have to actually go out into space, travel back in time, and then try to figure out where Earth is.
You're messing up all of these wonderful science fiction ideas.
You absolutely got it. Like the ones, you know, what was that one recently where the guy walks on the frozen place and all of that kind of stuff. Anyway, all these time travel things where people communicate across time, the distance they have to communicate becomes pretty impressive.
My cell phone doesn't have that great a range.
I
wouldn't be able to talk to myself back in time.
As I pointed out to somebody a long time ago when it was some kind of movie where people went back in time, or book, they went back in time and they were the dinosaurs and all of that. And I said, That's pretty amazing. Not the time travel.
that's the fact
that when those particular dinosaurs were wandering around, the Earth was on the opposite side of the galaxy from where it is today, which means that they traveled
a long way.
A really long distance in a fairly short period of time. And
well, see, that's the thing. A short period of time, in this case, isn't any time because you're backwards in time.
Yeah, but while I was sitting there in the movie theater, they appeared to have traveled to the other side of the galaxy, which even in Star Trek they couldn't do. Even at warp whatever, they could not get to the other side of the galaxy in a couple of seconds.
But we, as human beings, are born with certain time travel abilities. We are able to move back in time in our own heads.
Unfortunately,
it's not very accurate.
The time travel that we do in our own heads is pretty consistently fantasy.
Right. From the perspective of behavioral economics, one of the things, and our listeners know this about me, this is Jake, by the way, is I study memory sometimes.
Yeah, he's Jake. You can tell because he's wearing the plaid shirt.
Yes.
I'm wearing the plain shirt.
Jeff wears plain. Jake wears plaid.
Right,
come on.
Right.
Listening audience, they
right.
should know
you
this
should be
by
able
now.
To pick this up immediately.
Right. All right. So I study memory. And one of the, I guess you would call it a cocktail party trick that I do for people is I ask them what they had to eat 2 weeks ago on Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
And unless they're on a special diet, most people can't tell me. Like, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, well, did you eat? And they generally, again, unless they're on a special diet or they just don't eat on Thursdays or some such, they say, yes, absolutely, I ate.
You have to be careful which day you pick, right?
Right. I say, so you ate on Thursday. You're positive of this. 2 weeks ago Thursday, you ate. And they say, yes, I'm absolutely positive I ate. And I say, how do you know? And they say, because I would remember not eating. So most of our memories are the absence of memories. So if the remembering that you didn't eat is how you would remember that you did eat.
Of course, we're perfectly rational.
Perfectly. I mean, we live in a fantasy world in our own heads. We have these specific memories that we hold and say these are completely accurate. But they're fed by pieces like that, like you had a big traumatic event or a big wonderful event on a given day, a marriage, and then you ask, okay, what time?
And they can be both the same event,
right?
Traumatic
and wonderful. And
wonderful, right.
Yes. So those things get memorized, but they get changed with time.
Oh, yes.
And when we think about people ask me again when I get to this point, well, what the heck does economics have to do with your memory? How does being able to manage money have anything to do with memory?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you want to understand how a casino works, you have to understand memory. If you want to understand how people keep thinking that they did better than they did or did worse than they did in the market, it has to do with memory. If people don't go to Vegas because the last time they were there, they lost a lot of money. Even though last time they were there, they lost a lot of money.
Right.
They remember the wins. They remember each win as if it was the final event. Even though when they left, they actually had debt on their credit cards.
I have concluded that investing in gaming companies from Las Vegas is very, very dangerous. And the reason is they keep claiming to have consistent profits.
Yes, but everybody I speak to that goes to Vegas comes back with winnings.
Everybody comes back and wins, which means that obviously they're faking the profits at the other end because these people I know.
Right.
And this then follows to the next thing. Most people, when making major decisions in their lives, consult the memories of the people who they know.
Right. They go, oh, yeah, I did win. Do you remember me winning? Yeah. Oh, yeah. See, we won.
And so they make decisions based on their friend's recollection of things, which is rather than the facts.
Right. If you actually carefully tallied your winnings at Vegas and you kept that log and you carried it around and you said this is what happened at Vegas, it's not as fun a story.
Well, wait a minute. That's a violation of the rules.
You're not supposed to keep a log.
What happens at Vegas
Stays at Vegas.
Stays at Vegas.
See, they even have it in their marketing slogan.
Yes, and I really think...
What you lose in Vegas stays in Vegas.
What I really think was true in the military aviation community, the particular municipality that we call Las Vegas,
yeah,
they refer to as lost wages.
Yeah, that could be it.
At least they used to when I was doing that.
And it also happens to be the number one destination for continuing education conferences for the financial world.
I don't know that that's a fact, but I do know that they get much better attendance.
I do know that it is a fact. I was looking at the at the sheets, yes.
Because I do know, for whatever it's worth, the brokerage world, the people who call themselves financial advisors, I do believe, based on all the advertisements I've seen, that Las Vegas is the... They get much better attendance at their conferences if they schedule them in Las Vegas rather than, let's say, Orlando.
Right.
And both are fantasy worlds.
Yes.
And it's which should tell you something about the brokerage industry, but that's all right.
Yeah.
Well, the telephone numbers haven't actually changed, but I thought I'd say them again because we've moved so far
they've
away
changed,
from them.
Right? They have changed
they've
in
changed.
Time and space has They've yeah. changed in that only. So
we could, radiate them out again.
Yeah, so let's do it.
The local telephone number, if you'd like to call us here at the Personal Wealth Coach and stimulate our brains to answer something that makes sense rather than rave on about inanities like brokers in Las Vegas.
Or memories and time travel.
Right. 773-1400 in East Bell County. Otherwise?
1-866-597-1400.
And someone has taken our advice and actually dared to call us on 773-1400. So, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, long-term listener. I heard on Lou Dobbs a couple of nights ago that only 50% of U.S. households are participating in the stock market. I was just curious, with the rapid demise of defined pensions and most people being in 401ks,
mm-hmm. right.
what has been the participation rate, say, since the 29 crash up till today? I'll hang up the message.
Okay. All right. Well, first I have to apologize for the first part. You said you were a longtime listener. I'm very sorry about that.
Well, you know, he listens to Lou Dobbs, too.
Right. So. And Lou Dobbs, I've seen this statistic pop up, and it's this 15% participation
really?
In
15?
The stock market. That's what was used. And really what they're talking about is people that have their own private stock portfolio. And that's the number that popped up. But the reality is different than that. The reality is closer to 60% of the United States has stock positions in their retirement portfolio or in their pension plan. It's a lot more than that. A lot more than that. If you think about... if you get into Social Security issues, you want to consider U.S. Treasuries as being part of the market. It is part of the market, and that's what Social Security is. It's not stock. It's not equity. But if you get into that area, basically anybody that's ever had a job has some of their livelihood tied up in the overall investment market of the world or of the United States. So participation in the stock market has fallen off, and I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, has fallen off since the crash of 2008. A lot of people got out of the market. However, that number is kind of misleading. Go ahead.
Well, there was 65% of Americans participating in the stock market in 2007.
Right. It has fallen since then. I think I can't remember the exact number, but it's like 61.
It's 52% now.
It was like 61 in 2009, and then it's dropped repeatedly. So 52%?
Yeah, it was 52%, and according to this, it fell from 2007 to 52% today. And I think there may be some truth. I think one of the things when you read these, and I just am flipping through this quickly, it doesn't, it includes mutual funds. Okay, good. That's probably accurate. This is my opinion.
Right.
And I think probably I've seen other numbers that indicated we were up around 75% or 70-some percent right around 2000, just before the market collapsed. By the way, a strong indicator of whether the market is overpriced is the percentage of Americans' households who are invested in the stock market in some form, whether it be in mutual funds or who at least acknowledge that they've invested in the stock market. And I presume that's through 401ks and everything else. And this is the point. When the last people get into the market, who are the people who don't normally, who don't literally, and we've told this story before, but I was wasn't Kerrville,
Fredericksburg,
and overheard this family next to us in 2000 talking about one of them, young man speaking to the patriarch of the family. He says, "I'm going to get me some of that Dale stock. It's about to split again. I figure it's about like a cow and a calf. You know, when a cow has a calf, they're worth more than they are when they're just a cow. So I figure when the stock splits, I'm going to get me some of that for that stock splits, and that way I'll have more money." And, you know, literally this was a case where somebody didn't know the difference between common stock and livestock.
And in some ways there isn't a difference, but in a lot of ways there's a huge difference.
So
in this particular case, there is a huge difference. When a stock split does not add value to a stock. And when people like that are getting involved in investing, it sounds like we're making fun of people. But just take a moment here. This goes back into the way we view ourselves, the way everyone views ourselves. Did you know, it sounds like I'm going to change the subject. I'm not changing the subject, I promise. 83% of U.S. drivers believe that they are above average drivers.
What I want to know, I really want somebody to study that 17% who know.
I'm a horrible driver. They must be really, really bad.
I don't know. They might be the best drivers out there because they know their weakness.
Right. And the reality is that if you take a population, then the average citizen is at the 50% mark. And above that is above average, and below that is below average. If you have people that have zero experience in the stock market, that by kind of definition means they have below average experience in the stock market. They will make below average decisions in the stock market unless they educate themselves really well. Unfortunately, part of the reason that you're hearing our voices today is that the education for the United States citizen in their investment portfolio is very lacking. We come out every Saturday to try to help a little bit, but it's like the smallest of Band-Aids possible. People really need to get, if you have money that is invested in the market, you need to get educated on it. You need to spend some time figuring out why you're doing what you're doing. There is science behind it. And it's kind of like if this science exists. If there were 52% of the American population involved in biology and nobody was studying biology, then there would be a problem.
I found the 15% number too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Basically, people with low income don't invest in the stock market.
Yep.
It's 15% of people with a family income of less than $30,000 per year are invested in the stock market in any form. And this is the point, and I've said this before. The largest differential that we can find, whether there's a cause and effect there is always questionable, but the largest difference we can find when we look at wealthy versus non-wealthy, when you look at this growing divide between the rich and the poor, is that people with higher incomes get more of their income from investing than people with lower
right.
incomes. And that doesn't mean, well, lower income people obviously can't afford to invest. Yes, they can. Lower income people, study after study after study has indicated that lower income people waste a larger percentage of their income on non-essentials than do higher income people. And I don't think there's any coincidence there. That's not a coincidence. I mean, what I'm saying is that, just as an example, and I realize it's an addiction, and if you happen to be a person who smokes and can't smoke, God bless you. But if you look at the quantity of money a smoker spends on cigarettes in a year, given 10 years, they wouldn't be a poor person anymore if they just dumped it into an index someplace.
Right.
And you can pick your index even. But the point is...
That has to do with gratification and being able to delay it.
And that's...
If you can delay gratification, you will not be poor.
And if you can't delay gratification and you get into the stock market, you'll probably...
You're going to lose a lot of money, yes.
So, because the stock market will hand you some anti-gratification in large doses for an extended period of time.
Now this kind of touches on another subject, because you mentioned it in passing here, but it's one, when you talk, there's this class concept that comes in that in other countries is very, very real. If you're talking about Great Britain, when you talk about who's invested, it's very easy to see it based on the strata of their culture, the classes that are involved. In the United States, that's not the case. And what we have seen over particularly numbers that came out in 2006 showed this very massive income gap between the wealthy and the poor. And you see this happen right before crashes. If you go back and plot this throughout history, you see this happens again and again and again before a big market crash.
Right.
And
a big
then,
economic crash.
Yeah, big economic crash. When times change significantly, the rich people get richer, the poor people get poorer, until a significant change in the market, and then that starts to reverse, and we've begun to see that. One of the big things that was used as the as proof of this is that back in 2006, the average Wall Street CEO, these are the financial firms of Wall Street, made 273 times the average employee's wages. 273. That is right up there, almost 300.
Right.
We are talking about a massive difference. People would have to work 273 years to make what their CEO made.
And
this year...
To date, we do not have a large sample of people who have worked 273
years. No, we're trying to find some people that have made it up to the CEO pay over a 273-year period.
But
we haven't seen it yet.
It has something to do with inflation adjustment. Yes.
Well, the average Wall Street CEO today earns 124 times the average wages, which is still... There are some people that could possibly live that long now.
Right.
We're looking at that. That's a possibility. But if you consider... The fact that that is half more, or it's less than half of what it was before, that the pay has dropped significantly, and that includes options and all the other things. Those always get included in these pay numbers.
But it does prove that all the Wall Street CEOs earn above average.
Actually, it proves that they do make more than
the average
employee
in
their firm. But they're now about half of what the average Fortune 500 CEO gets.
Well, that's, and there's a really good news story today on that.
So if you think about that for a second, Wall Street, the big fat cats, the CEOs there are now below average pay for CEOs across as a large company CEO.
Let's be careful about talking about fat cats. I have a couple of them in my house.
Yes, they are quite fat.
Insulted.
Quite fat.
We are going to break for commercials. We'll be back on the other side with more of The Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to give us a call, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And in the immortal words of the Gubernator, we'll be back. With more of The Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure on this Saturday, April 11th in the year of our Lord 2015. Do you realize more than a quarter of 2015 is gone? It's gone.
Where did it go?
It's back behind us in space and time. It's around the galaxy counterclockwise. Well, a lot depends on which side of the galaxy you say is up or down, but there is a general consensus as to the upside, and I think it's only a consensus because if you look at it from that side, the galaxy is turning clockwise.
Right.
There is no...
If you look at it from the other direction, though, it is counterclockwise.
Counterclockwise and going backwards in time, so we have to be careful. And the funny thing is, and this is one of those things that, as an astronomer, has sort of...
Which way is up?
Fried my brains over the years. The Earth rotates around the sun, obviously revolves around the sun, I think is the proper term, as do the planets, and it's called the plane of the ecliptic of our solar system, which is at almost perfect right angles to that of the galaxy,
mm-hmm.
which somebody messed up there somewhere is all I got to figure. Because, you know, you'd think they would be kind of lined up with one another and you know, but we're not quite at perfect right angles, but we're pretty skewed.
That's why we can see so much of the Milky Way at night when we look up at the sky.
Because it's vertical.
If it were flat with the rest of us, we really wouldn't be able to tell much about it.
Well, you know, it'd be like wraparound if it was up in the northern hemisphere. And, of course, if we were sort of oriented where it was down south, it actually would be right around the equator, which we can see from most of the Earth. But it's not. It's like vertical. That's why when you see, I don't know if you probably don't look at it, but if you were looking at a picture of the Milky Way as seen from Earth, which I've taken and published and other people have too, it's really always sort of fascinating because it looks like this cloud rising vertically up above the horizon because we're sitting at right angles to the Milky Way. So it's kind of a coin flip as to which way you want to say is up. I mean, if we say...
Well, we had this coin flip here, too, but we decided
that north was that way.
Well, this time we did. We used to say east was north or up on a map.
And
that's why, by the way, for useless trivia information for our listeners, which is probably the only reason why they listen,
right,
is when people orient themselves on a map, orient means east.
Right.
That was because east used to be up on the map.
It was only
when we started using compasses regularly that we started having north be upward on the map.
And when I was in the Army and they taught orienteering, that's what it's called.
You're right. Boy Scouts
orienteering, and they said the first thing you do is you orient your map to the north.
Which means east your map to the north.
And I said, that doesn't make any sense. And the sergeant said, why doesn't it make any sense? And I said, orient is east. So you would... say, and I can understand if you want to take the right side of the map and point it east. Now, that would make perfectly good sense. But to take the top side of the map and point it north and say that's the orient.
I had a little thing, a joke that I played at school, and I put white out on the compass on the map for the east direction.
Mm-hmm.
I disoriented all the maps.
You did.
It was quite fun.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And... people were wandering around disoriented.
They didn't even act like it was a big deal, and I just totally disoriented all their maps.
I think most people are disoriented most of the time. Because unless you are a Muslim, you probably most of the time don't know which way east is. Anyway.
Right. Well, this is another one, and the subject kind of touches on this, that ignorance is rampant. When we use words, when we think about concepts, we tend to make these big assumptions. We're just talking about Wall Street pay. And every year, the state of New York comes out with the securities employees of Wall Street, period. They call it the securities employees of the city of New York.
Mm-hmm.
So basically Wall Street. And they come out with this... because they do taxes there, they have their own income taxes. The city has its income taxes, right, and the state has its income taxes.
Well, we really miss a lot of fun by not having a state or a city income tax.
Right. I'm glad we missed that fun. Thank you. Anyway, they come out with this number every year, and it's this huge number. They say the amount of money put together just in bonuses in any given year for New York City in the securities employment. And in 2014, it was $28.5 billion, with a B, dollars.
Mm-hmm. Right.
People say this, and there have been quite a lot of news publications. Here's a blurb here, a headline. Wall Street bonuses could pay off these states' student loans. And then it has a chart of you could pay off Massachusetts. All of the student loans of Massachusetts could be paid off with the bonuses paid this year. By Wall Street.
I think you should pay off Texas student loans.
Well, Texas isn't listed because we have more student loans than they have in billions. So
okay.
It's always the small states that could all have their... So it's not very nice.
Right. Rhode Island. Yeah.
Or it could pay off 9 states, including Rhode Island. Rhode Island, Hawaii, Montana, Delaware, South Dakota, Vermont, North Dakota, Alaska, and Wyoming could all be paid, all of their student loans paid off with the bonuses of Wall Street. So we're just like, wow, well, that's interesting. We have now two completely different subjects being compared to each other as if it's important.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to do the population search here of Alaska.
12.
Okay. Population of Alaska is 736,000 people.
Uh-huh.
Do you know how many securities employees there are in the city of New York? 1,648,733.
Well,
there are twice as many stockbrokers in New York City as the entire population, more than twice as many.
Yeah, of Alaska.
Of Alaska. And so, yes, their bonuses could pay off the student loans of Alaska. Come on, people. Talk about populations, talk about income, talk about a lot of things, but let's not mix them all together.
What publication was that in, just out of curiosity?
It was in Vocative, which is a slightly left-leaning
publication. Yeah, I would start to say that is a, all the rich people should give the poor people
money. Right, right, but it's the same publication that posted from the Wall Street Journal about the pay gap getting smaller on Wall Street. So they at least attempt some form of balance, and some of their writers actually recognize that there are differences in the things that we're talking about here. If you look at Hawaii, Alaska, Wyoming, and so on, something that they don't say, this is fascinating. If you took the money that was paid and bonuses to the people in Wall Street, it wouldn't have paid off the people in Wall Street's student loans. Or it would have paid off the people in Wall Street's student loans.
And it didn't. That would make perfectly good sense.
Yeah. When you think about these people, we know people on Wall Street.
We do.
And there are people that work, and Wall Street becomes really big in that it kind of goes all the way across the United States. If you work in the securities industry, people automatically assume that you work on Wall Street.
Well, I keep telling them, we're not on Wall Street, we're on Main Street.
You're right. People go, you're a Wall Street guy. Well,
no, we're Main
not
Street.
Really,
we're
actually.
Just, no, we're actually on Main Street. 918 North Main Street is our business address.
Right. And all of this, I'm saying, there are types of industries that make more money than other industries. There are types of professions that make more money than other professions. And that should be something that guides an understanding of what profession to choose, not a thing to stand back and say, well, I didn't choose that profession, therefore that profession must pay me. That's a place where, you know, that's malleable as to who, if you're successful in business, are you expected to pay off everybody else's student loans? Well, yes, as a matter of fact, you are. In fact, the reality is that those of us that pay taxes in the state of Texas, if we do well enough to pay a lot of taxes, we are paying a significant portion of a lot of teachers and firefighters and police officers student loans, and we're okay with that.
Let me, as long as we're on this subject, by the way, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. Telephone number is in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
There's an article in the Wall Street Journal that is a prime example of why you should never believe a headline. Literally, never believe a headline.
Can you put that in a headline form?
No.
This headline says, never believe headlines.
The headline.
Wait a minute.
The headline is by Laura Sanders. And there's her picture on there. In April 10th, top 20% of earners pay 84% of income tax. And it goes on to then show why, and then the subtitle in the blurb that I saw that took me to this was bottom 20% paid by government. And that is one of those things that you hear bandied about.
Wait a minute. The bottom 20% of taxes were paid by the government?
No. The bottom 20% of wage earners actually receive net money from the government.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
But they don't.
No.
That's the interesting thing. You read this through this long article, and it talks about how the wealthy, in essence, it's a great deal of data about how the more wealthy you are, the larger the percentage of the total income tax revenue you supply to the United States government, until you get down to the last three paragraphs. And it went on and on about the fact that the lowest 20% of earners in the United States receive in more money back from the government than they pay in income taxes. But then it says people receiving such payments do not pay other federal taxes, do pay other federal taxes, of course, such as those for Social Security and Medicare. If those taxes are included, their share of federal taxes paid by the lowest two quintiles turns positive.
Yes.
So basically, when you hear that half of Americans don't pay income tax, well, that means
true.
If you don't count Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid and all that, because the bottom line to it is a person in the bottom 20% who is working pays more to the federal government than they get back.
Yeah. And
it's like the rest of us.
Yeah, that's a reality here. And anytime a headline like that happens, I tend to think it's kind of a left-leaning headline or ignorant.
No, this is a right-leaning headline.
The reason why I would say
that rich people pay too much taxes.
The reason why I would say it tends to be that ignorance makes it more left-leaning, because it is ignoring the fact that we pay Social Security and Medicare taxes. It's almost like that's not really taxes. The fact is that anybody that's working pays 15% of their pay goes off to that before they even really, and they don't even know it. If they're being paid by somebody else, it only looks like they're paying 7.4% of their money. But the company's paying 7.4% as well.
The subtitle
here. 15%.
And the bottom 20%, ? They get paid by Uncle Sam. Oh, come on.
And the reality is, again, reality is fun. If you look at the people that are receiving income from Uncle Sam, military retirement, Social Security, you could make some really crazy graphs that say these people are getting more out of the government than they're paying in this year.
Yeah.
So they must be leeching from the government. But the reality is that they put that money in earlier. It's how we account for things that's important.
What is it Benjamin Disraeli is famous to have said?
Yes, there are three types of lies in order of severity.
Lies, damned lies, and statistics.
Yeah.
Speaking of lies, damned lies, and statistics, we probably ought to report on the market.
Oh, yeah. Let's do that.
I love that. Okay, the trader in Barron's today. Stocks keep climbing as bad news turns good. I love. This was a good headline.
This is what happens when news repents. If you've got bad news and it repents, it turns good.
Yeah, what
you
happened?
You have good news all of a sudden.
What happened is the market actually dropped earlier in the week.
Was there an earthquake?
Because the numbers on the market,
the numbers dropped.
The dollar value
okay, I was
going to
say
the
elevation. That's a
major indices dropped because on Friday when the market wasn't open,
right?
The Department of Labor releases the information that only 126,000 people were added to the payrolls in the month of
non-farm payrolls.
Non-farm payrolls, yes. That I've always wondered about that. Why don't we leave farm payrolls on there? Anyway.
Because there's too much fluctuation. You got migrant workers that come in for
payrolls. Anyway.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you have to hire millions of people in harvest season,
this looks funny.
This
was seen by some people initially as really bad news. The economy is sliding into recession. The world will momentarily come to an end.
Oh, yes.
And so the market went down. Well, then as time went by and people had an opportunity to discuss this among each – well, actually, what I think is the traders go to these bars on Wall Street after they get done trading on Wall Street, and they all discuss this with each other and over whiskey or whatever it is they're taking. They change their minds, and they come back the next day. And the reason the market went up Friday, the consensus among traders on Friday for the rise in the market is they looked at the previous Friday's job release numbers low, the ones that caused the market to go down early in the week, and said, whoa, that's really good news, because it probably means the Federal Reserve won't raise interest rates for a while, so that bad news is really good news, so we will buy a bunch of stocks and the market will go up for exactly the same reason
that it went down yesterday.
Earlier in the week.
Yes. Brilliant.
That's what I say. That is so accurate.
We call this dichotomy.
I call it cognitive dissonance.
Right. It is the same thing. It is the ability to hold two absolutely opposing ideas in your mind comfortably.
and shift between them from day to day.
Oh, yeah. This is good news. Well, no, it's bad. No, it's good news.
And you got to remember, though, that the traders make money when trading goes on, whether it goes up or down.
Right. It's like Vegas. If gambling's happening, they're happy.
I can hear the brokers now. You need to sell. We're going back into recession. We had low job numbers, so people sell. And they said, wait a minute.
We had low job.
Buy
immediately.
The Fed probably won't raise rates until September instead of June.
Bah.
So you need to buy because we had low job numbers. And of course, people come in and buy the same stocks that they sold early in the week.
Yeah, I still tend to think that the Fed is going to start raising interest rates in June, just like they said they would. That the market's interpretation of this one amount of employment numbers, the reality is that can be really easily seasonally adjusted into oblivion because of
and it can be adjusted
snowstorms
with new data
and all kinds of good stuff
next month. And the other thing is, now that people have dug into this data just a bit, the economists are pretty much coming around to the position that this was an anomaly.
Yeah.
And it was an anomaly caused by bad weather. Like, well, duh.
Bad weather and strikes in California.
Yes.
Put that together and you have low employment gains.
But the numbers that have come out, as I said in the newsletter that I just finished, which will be published this week, the thing, you know, this is the issue. Okay, we had 295,000 jobs when we unexpected high in February, and now we have 126,000 new jobs in March.
It's an unexpected low. What's going on here?
Is the economy going great guns, or is it falling on its face? Well, the answer is to be found in something that you won't hear much or read much in the media. It's called the Leading Economic Indicators,
right,
published by the Conference Board.
If you look at unemployment or employment numbers, you're looking at lagging indicators.
Right.
So that doesn't tell you what's happening now. It tells you what was happening a few months ago.
And I explain in the letter why you don't see the leading economic indicators in the headlines. Here was the actual press release from the Conference Board. March's leading economic indicators up 0.2%. Following January's leading economic indicators up 0.2%, which were preceded by December's leading economic indicators up 0.4%.
Yes.
Boy, now that's riveting headlines. And it doesn't exactly cause people to either fear or get excited. But what it says
when people start talking, the ISM non-manufacturing index declined or inclined. Supplier deliveries dipped or grew. People start thinking, what does this even mean?
Right. And
it's not a headline.
So what – the answer to the – what? By the way, this 0.2%, if you add all that up, that comes to a 2.4% annual growth in GDP, which is exactly how fast we've been growing.
Yeah,
so the leading indicators
– no changes.
By the way, as I also wrote in the newsletter – the leading economic indicators will occasionally go negative and then turn around and alarm us and think, hey, we're going to have a recession. And then they turn around and cancel the alarm and come back positive again. We don't have a recession. So they create a few false alarms. But this is the important issue. Since 1916, when the leading economic indicators are first published by the Conference Board, we have never had a recession that was not forecast by
the
Conference Board's leading economic indicators.
Right.
So it's almost like in order to have a recession in the United States, you have to have written permission from the Conference Board,
right,
which is a nonprofit organization.
Well, the Conference Board has also predicted, using the same numbers, if you would call them predictions, have predicted recessions that didn't happen.
That's what I'm
as
saying.
Well.
Right.
But it's always been right. That there hasn't been a recession that hasn't been predicted.
It doesn't say that we can't have a healthy economy without their permission.
Right.
But
just
we cannot have a recession without their written approval.
Right.
So as long as they haven't issued the written approval for a recession.
It's pretty easy to follow this.
Now that we have Google and the Internet, it is. But it used to be, if the newspapers didn't cover it, you didn't know what they were saying.
This goes back to that same kind of memory thing, where we remember things by not remembering them. Well, we can only have recessions if the Conference Board says we can.
Right.
It's the same concept.
Anyway, far as the stock market is concerned, the 52-week return, total return, of the No, of the nominal return of the Dow Jones Industrial Average, 12.67%. Year-to-date, up 1.32. Weekly, up 1.66. So you could say, last week, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up more than the entire year-to-date.
Or the year-to-date was...
less than, yes, last week's return.
Or a big part of the year-to-date was last week's return.
Well, yeah, it was actually over 100% of this year's
return comes from last week.
Was last week, yes. 100 and, yeah, that would be, that makes sense. S&P 500 up 1.7, up 2.10 for the week. The NASDAQ up 5.49 year-to-date, up 25% for 1 year. And you know what's funny? People are still scared, and we're about out of time.
Yep. Now, we've got lots of stuff to talk about next hour. I want to talk about the triple mandate that the Fed is laboring under, and I want to talk some more about what's going on with the market and where we're going. And
I want to talk about a cool new IRS ruling.
Oh, that sounds like
a lot of fun. It's really a cool one.
Can you read the regulation?
We can read it out loud. But actually, it is their ruling on the regulation that is really cool because it means that people can do stuff that they couldn't do before.
No, so it's that will get all of our like-minded three listeners to pay attention next hour.
Well, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and if you would like to contact us off the air for whatever reason, either to tell us we did good work, bad work, or say, please manage my money, you can contact us locally. We have a voicemail on the weekend, live people during the week at 947-1111.
You can reach that same number toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email us at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. Or you can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can listen to podcasts. You can read our philosophy. You can see our made-for-radio faces.
Thepersonalwealthcoach.com.